KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound, a citizens group formed in 1991 to protect and restore Puget Sound and the Northwest Straits. Kathy also sits on the Northwest Straits Commission and the Puget Sound Partnership's Ecosystem Coordination Board. Kathy Fletcher is here today to evaluate the state of Puget Sound's oil spill prevention and preparedness. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about People for Puget Sound?
Yes. Well, People for Puget Sound is almost 20 years old. We've been working hard during those 20 years to protect and restore Puget Sound. We do education. We do hands-on habitat restoration using volunteers. And we advocate for improved policies that will protect Puget Sound. So we pretty much cover the bases for what Puget Sound needs. We consider ourselves Puget Sound's advocate, speaking for the critters who don't have a voice of their own.
How vulnerable is Puget Sound to an oil spill?
Unfortunately, Puget Sound is extremely vulnerable to an oil spill, and we've had more than enough wake-up calls in the form of spills that, in the context of the Gulf spill, are tiny. Nevertheless, even a small spill causes a lot of damage.
What is the primary source of risk for a major oil spill in Puget Sound?
Fortunately, we don't have offshore oil rigs of the type that blew out in the Gulf, but we do have ships that carry an enormous amount of oil. We have tankers, oil tankers, that are carrying crude oil to our refineries. We have four large refineries in the north part of Puget Sound, two near Ferndale and two near Anacortes. And then we have a smallish refinery in Tacoma as well. So we have a lot of crude oil coming in. Virtually every day there's a large tanker full of oil coming in to Puget Sound. And then, of course, the product, some of the product gets shipped out. And maybe something people don't think about a lot is that every large ship out there has an enormous fuel supply on board. And those fuel tanks pose a huge risk as well. Some of our spills that people may remember around here, the New Carissa ship that ran aground in Oregon, was not an oil tanker, but it carried enough fuel oil to cause a big spill. We also transport oil and oil-related products around in barges, and spills can occur at different points in the process. They can occur, of course, with a collision or running up on the rocks, but they can also occur when fuel or oil is being loaded or unloaded off of ships. And even a pipeline can cause an oil spill if it ruptures.
What would be a worst-case scenario for an oil spill in Puget Sound in terms of amount and effect?
I think that the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska is what we should be thinking about as a kind of an example of the kind of spill that could occur in Puget Sound. An oil tanker with a disaster could spill millions and millions of gallons of oil. Now, the Exxon Valdez, the official estimate was that it spilled 11 million gallons of oil. Some of the later studies suggest that that was off, that it might have even been 20-plus million gallons. But it's important to remember that even at that huge amount, it didn't lose all of its cargo. So an oil tanker carries much more than the Exxon Valdez spill, and we certainly have that kind of ship coming and going from Puget Sound.
Would you elaborate on the environmental implications of such a spill in Puget Sound?
The environmental implications, it's probably important to think about several different issues. First of all, most of Puget Sound is a pretty confined area, so spills actually hit the beach pretty fast. You know, we went through a lot of agony of wondering when the Gulf oil spill would actually hit the shore. Well, in Puget Sound, that would happen within hours, so that's a vulnerability just because of our geography. Secondly, as most people know, we have a lot of species in Puget Sound that are already on the brink of extinction. And so an oil spill, a significant oil spill, could actually be the death knell for some of our endangered species. In fact, when the government decided to list the southern resident orca whale population as an endangered species, the scientists concluded that actually the biggest risk posed for the survival of that species is oil spills. So that we have a diminished ecosystem out there is also a reason we should worry about oil spills. But the thing is, when an oil spill hits, if it's a big oil spill, you get a lot of oil all at once, and whether it's a mammal who is trying to breathe in that stuff, or a bird getting its feathers oiled, or the long-term implications of having that much oil in the system and getting into the food web, all those things can be very serious in impact. And we know in the Exxon Valdez situation that there is still oil in the beaches in Alaska more than 20 years after that spill. So these things linger.
What would be the economic implications of a spill in Puget Sound?
Our economy would definitely suffer with a major oil spill here. First of all, there are a lot of businesses that depend on tourism and recreation, and nobody wants to be a tourist or recreate in an oil-filled environment. Secondly, a lot of economic activity in Puget Sound revolves around our shellfish growing, our delicious oysters and clams, and of course, those would be directly affected if oil came into the area of those shellfish beds. In addition, the waterfront property owners, of course, a huge part of the value of their property and, of course, what they enjoy would be affected by an oil spill. So there are lots of economic implications to an oil spill.
What measures are currently in place to protect Puget Sound from oil spills?
We have a number of laws at the federal and state level and regulations that are designed to prevent oil spills. One of the most important things that we've achieved here in Puget Sound in recent years is that we have a tugboat stationed out at Nia Bay now permanently, and it's funded by the shipping industries. That tugboat is there if a ship gets in trouble to go to immediate assistance before that ship winds up on the rocks. And in the years that we've had a tugboat out there, it's gone out more than 40 times, actually, to assist ships and other vessels in trouble. So that's one thing we have here that's very important. It's because our ports, where there are lots of tugboats around that can be of assistance, are pretty far from where those tankers and large ships turn in from the ocean. So that's one thing we have. We also require our oil companies and the shippers of oil to have equipment and training and response capability. Some of that isn't quite up to snuff. And after a recent spill, actually a few years ago, a spill that we had that occurred during a loading operation where oil was being taken from tanks on shore onto a barge and a spill occurred, we now have requirements that protective booms be put in place during those transfer operations. A couple loopholes in that regulation, but we do have protection there. We don't have near enough protection, but certainly there's been improvement over the years. And it's interesting and sad, but every time there's an oil spill, there's usually a lesson or two learned from that that ends up increasing our protection.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound. Our topic is the state of oil spill prevention and preparedness in Puget Sound. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you elaborate on the federal regulations that are in place to protect from oil spills?
Yes. After the Exxon Valdez spill, the Congress passed the Oil Prevention Act. This was in 1990. The spill occurred in 1989. And that law basically requires that potential spillers of oil, like shipping companies or oil companies, need to have plans in place both to prevent and to respond to oil spills. It also sets up a fund to pay for damages. It also requires the oil companies or the spillers to be financially responsible when a spill occurs. A few things need to be tweaked about that, but it basically sets up the fundamental system and puts the Coast Guard as the lead agency in charge of oil spills when they occur.
How well has this law been implemented in Washington State?
This law has been implemented adequately, but it quickly became apparent that the state needed to augment what the feds were able to do. And in fact, the state passed its first Oil Spill Prevention and Response Act in 1991, so also in response to the Exxon Valdez spill. The state's view was that the federal requirements weren't strict enough, and also that the priority placed on spills might ebb and flow, if you will, with other priorities of the Coast Guard. And that certainly has played out over the years as the Coast Guard has become increasingly saddled with security responsibilities. They're part of the Homeland Security Agency. So the state actually passed its own laws and regulations, has continued to do so, and it basically dovetails with the Coast Guard, with the feds, and figuring out who does what. And there's a pretty good division of labor there. But unfortunately, neither our state or federal regulations are adequate at this point. We still need to do more.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that we don't have the offshore rigs. Is that likely to continue to be the case, or has there been an effort to have drilling underwater off the coast of Washington?
There's been an effort. There's been talk about it over the years. We currently ban offshore oil drilling within the state waters, which is 3 miles out. And there's a moratorium on federal activity, which would be further out. And we also have a marine sanctuary off the coast of Washington, which does not allow for offshore oil development within the boundary of the sanctuary, which is really quite a large area. I also hear, and I don't know if this is true because it's probably proprietary information, that the potential for huge oil discovery is probably not as great off of our coast. So we might be lucky in that sense. So while there's continuing concern that there may be offshore oil development coming off our coast or off the coast of BC or on further south, that could affect us, of course, we don't see that as our biggest threat at the moment. We see other issues as being more important right here.
How well has the shipping industry responded overall to oil spill prevention efforts?
The shipping industry has, in my opinion, they've done what's required, but they have generally resisted strengthening our regulations. They're very conscious of cost, and I think they put the cost issue above everything. And of course, it's kind of a short-sighted cost issue, because when a spill occurs, as BP is finding out, your cost exposure is huge. But we've had a lot of difficulty increasing the stringency of our oil spill regulations due to opposition from the shipping industry.
How well prepared, in your view, is the shipping industry to handle oil spills that occur?
One of the biggest issues today here in Puget Sound and in the waters of Washington State is that we are not prepared to deal with a large spill. The state actually did a study recently to determine our preparedness for what they called a worst case scenario. And that term worst case, of course, has gotten a lot of currency with the Gulf spill. The question down there, of course, was, well, didn't anybody imagine this might happen? And what was the plan, guys? There wasn't a plan. And we're in the same situation here. With the equipment that we have and the requirements that we have, we are maybe able to respond to a spill 1/5 the size of the Exxon Valdez spill. And that's if everything goes perfectly. Everything goes off without a hitch, the weather is perfect, and everything runs smoothly. Well, that's not very good. The idea is that over the course of a spill response, that other equipment comes in from elsewhere to help out. We see in the Gulf situation how long that can take before the call even goes out to get the stuff. We've seen in real life spills here in Puget Sound that, the outboard engine on the boat that was supposed to carry the boom out there isn't working. All these practical issues, or, it's windy and these booms are not the heavy duty kind of booms that you need in windy conditions. We are not prepared to respond not only to the worst case scenario, but even an easily imaginable scenario. We're woefully underprepared.
What kind of efforts are going on to change this, to make us more prepared?
The Department of Ecology, which is our state agency responsible for spill prevention and response, has stepped up the practice drills that they're responsible for doing to test the system. That's another thing that this study last year found out, was that we didn't really have enough on the water, so to speak, drills, as opposed to on the tabletop drills. We didn't have enough on the water drills to really test the system to its limit. And so that has been stepped up. I think the Department of Ecology is also very focused on the fact that the existing program that we have, as inadequate as it is, it's got a lot of really good features to it. Even at our current level, the funding is running out, and they need to address the funding shortfall. And so the department hasn't really stepped up to address this worst case scenario as strongly as we would like to see. But of course, they know that that is out there, and we hope to work with them and the legislature to address that problem.
Where do most of the financial resources for oil spill prevention and preparedness come from?
We have a tax that was passed in that original state oil spill prevention act that was passed right after the Exxon Valdez of one nickel per barrel of oil that is brought into the state. So a ship full of oil has to pay this little nickel a barrel tax, and that is the money that the Department of Ecology uses to fund its spill prevention and response program. It's got a couple of details to it in terms of some of the money being set aside for a response account, but the bottom line is that nickel has not changed since 1991, and it's woefully out of date due to the cost of the program, inflation, and the fact that we now have a much greater appreciation of the nature of the program that's really needed. So that nickel needs to be increased. It should be indexed to inflation, or it should be increased, or some other mechanism is needed to come up with a sensible long-term funding plan.
Are there efforts to make that change in the upcoming Washington State Legislature?
It's been a topic now for several years of how to improve that, either to improve the formula or to get rid of a very major loophole. Even that nickel, a lot of it gets refunded to the oil companies if they ship product out after they've brought crude in. You might ask, well, why if you ship oil over the waters twice, would you get your nickel back? Shouldn't you have to pay it twice? Well, there's a lot of interstate commerce discussion about that. But the bottom line is there's a huge loophole that could be filled potentially. And we expect this issue to come back and back until it's solved. And hopefully this next legislative session will see a solution.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound. Our topic is the state of oil spill prevention and preparedness in Puget Sound. How well are we prepared here in Puget Sound compared to other parts of the U.S.?
You know, I haven't made a study of how well or poorly prepared other places are. But as much as I've been a critic of our situation here and an advocate for increasing prevention and response here, I was still shocked to watch what happened in the Gulf. It was as if they never imagined that this would occur. The fact that the response was so slow and so inadequate, and now we're literally months into the spill, and they're still dealing with fundamental issues of, well, if we recover a lot of oil, do we have enough barges and ships to put it in? Or where booms should go, and the fact that the booms that they put out get washed up on the beaches and nobody seems to be there with the right kind of boom positioned in the right way. This is shocking. And I like to think that things would go a little bit better here. Although, as I've said, I know that we are really not prepared either to deal with a big one.
What do you think the most important things to do are in terms of being better prepared for a spill?
Well, I have to always say, because it's the most important thing, that you don't want the spill to occur in the first place. You have to do everything you can to prevent it. And so in the Gulf case, it was the failure of the backup systems, the blowout preventer, and the human decision making that went along the way, where warning signs were not heeded and cost cutting and haste seemed to be the watchwords of that operation. There are a lot of elements to prevention, and part of it's equipment, part of it is the mentality, and part of it is what the regulations are. If a spill occurs, and we always have to operate on the assumption that spills may occur and they could be horrible, the most important thing is what happens in the initial hours after the spill occurs, because the more time that goes by, the further the oil spreads and the less effective your strategies are to collect the oil that is spreading along. So after prevention, the next most important thing is, what can you do immediately? What equipment, personnel, training, and contingency planning, you know, have you imagined the different ways this could happen, and are you ready to go? Do you have a strategy in place? Again, the Gulf spill showed, because there wasn't a response quickly, things were out of hand by the time any meaningful response was underway. I am not an advocate of the use of dispersants And that's something that is very contentious, of course. A dispersant, it's like detergent. It helps break up the oil into smaller and smaller bits. But the oil doesn't go away. And I think that we're conducting a vast experiment in the Gulf now with these dispersants, and we may end up having a whole bunch more toxic effects with the oil in smaller bits. When the oil is ugly and thick and black and on the surface, you actually have more of a chance of collecting some of it. But if you've already applied the dispersants, then I fear that the long-term effects are serious. So I don't put dispersants on my list. I think the thing that I would stress is to have the people and the plans and the equipment to do the quickest response possible to contain the damage and to maximize your chances at collecting the spilled oil. That being said, I think we all have to be realists that even with a crack plan and everything ready to go, you still can't recover everything you spill. That's why you have to prevent these things.
You've alluded to this a bit already, but what do you see as the major lessons from the Gulf spill for Puget Sound?
I think the number one lesson from the Gulf spill is that we need to specifically plan for a worst-case scenario, that we can no longer imagine that, some kind of a run-of-the-mill average sort of a spill is where we should be ready, and we can no longer imagine that, if we have a truly big spill, we'll just have to call in help from elsewhere, so we shouldn't really gear up for the large spill here. I think the lesson from the Gulf is you define what that worst case is, you get ready for it, you gear up for it, and you don't depend on anybody else in those initial hours and days. You have to have in the area, at hand, the people and equipment to do the maximum amount.
Oil spill equipment has been sent from Puget Sound to the Gulf. To what extent does this affect the ability to respond to a potential spill here in Puget Sound?
Well, it worries me that our equipment is being sent off to the Gulf, and I say that knowing that they need all the help they can get. But it also worries me that we're more exposed now. With every piece of equipment that leaves here, that's one little bit less that we're prepared should a spill occur here. I think this is another flaw in the thinking about oil spill response that seems to have been accepted by industry and government, which is you should assume that if you have a spill, you're going to be able to call in everybody and all the equipment from elsewhere to help you out. I know that the Department of Ecology, our state agency, is very concerned about maintaining our response capability here in Washington. And I don't think they will sit by and let everything go off to the Gulf. But already quite a bit of equipment has left. I think the Navy has sent 7 out of 9 or 10 of its skimming boats. And it's starting to sound like we may not have enough left here if something horrible happens.
Who makes the decision whether or not to send equipment?
I believe that the Coast Guard is essentially calling the shots about that.
How do the threats to Puget Sound from an oil spill from the shipping industry compare to the daily spills that come, for example, from the oil and stormwater?
It's really important that you bring this up because there's a lot of oil in stormwater runoff. And on a daily basis, monthly basis, yearly basis, the vast amount of oil pollution that gets into Puget Sound, and it is vast, it's on the order of a couple million gallons a year just in runoff, does a lot of damage. And it's unseen damage for the most part because it's not huge, globby tar balls or oil slicks or even visible sheens in many cases. It's poison that gets into the environment, gets into the food web, and we certainly have ample evidence that the primary pollutant in stormwater is actually petroleum.
What are some of the efforts going on to try to deal with this stormwater problem?
So we're making a number of advancements in stormwater management, but I think we're also way behind where we need to be. Essentially what happens with stormwater is that as you pave over the landscape, be it in streets and parking lots or even rooftops, you diminish the ability of the earth to absorb the rain that falls. And instead, you set up a situation where the rain washes whatever it is, dirt, grit, oil, pesticides, whatever it is on the land gets washed directly into the streams and lakes and Puget Sound. The way to stop that problem is probably not to get rid of roofs and streets, but to use materials that are capable of absorbing water and slowing water down and curtailing the ability of that pollution to get to the nearest stream or lake or Puget Sound. There are a lot of things you can do at home by using rain gardens and pervious, meaning soakable through pavement on your driveway, even a green roof like there is on City Hall here in Seattle, where soils and vegetation on the roof can absorb a lot of the water. These strategies, whether they're at the single home level or in a whole community, can actually dramatically hold back storm flow runoff. And there are lots of benefits to that. The pollution doesn't move into the water bodies, and we don't get the kinds of floods and devastating impacts that stormwater causes just because it's a lot of water moving through the system. These strategies for controlling stormwater, in addition to cutting down on the kind of pollution that gets there in the first place by, you know, you don't change your oil and then pour your oil down the storm drain anymore. That used to happen a lot. Yeah. Hopefully, fewer people are using pesticides and other poisons that get into the storm drains. You can cut back directly on the kind of pollution. These kinds of strategies are starting to show up in regulations and permits, and we're going to see more and more of that. But one of the key issues is that local governments, who are kind of holding the bag on controlling stormwater pollution and runoff, need an infusion of funding to do the job right, to really, you know, to get on top of this. And that's another pending bit of business for the legislature, to look at how we're going to fund a meaningful stormwater control program.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message, I think, is we are capable of protecting and restoring the health of our marine environment. We know lots about how to do that, but we have to demand that it occur. And that means that we need to become activists. That means that we need to do the things in our own homes and lifestyles that can contribute to a healthy Puget Sound. And it means we need to get involved as volunteers. And all of those things will add up to saving Puget Sound. And if we don't do those things, we're close enough to losing that I fear that's a real possibility. So I would encourage people to get involved with People for Puget Sound, to learn more. There are lots of opportunities to learn more and to get involved and to become activists. And don't be a stranger to your county council person or your city council person or your state legislator. These people are making decisions every day that affect Puget Sound.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kathy.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound. For more information, check on the web at www.pugetsound.org. Again, that's pugetsound.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.